Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 31st of March. First hour of our program today, the U.S. auto industry. What changes we're going to see and have already seen in the auto industry. Yesterday, of course, Rick Wagoner, chief executive of GM, who was asked to resign by the Obama administration, did just that. He said that he had been urged to step aside, and the president said the resignation is not meant as a condemnation of him, but a recognition that it will take a new vision and a new direction to create the GM of the future. The governor of Michigan has said that Mr. Wagoner was a sacrificial lamb, and she didn't know if his departure ultimately would matter. Our guest this hour, a University of Michigan economist, Donald Grimes, said that he was puzzled by the need for Wagoner to leave and said the greater question is the viability of a smaller GM going forward. There are a lot of people who are concerned about why the head of GM and not the head of some of the banks that have failed, and there are others who ask maybe those people are next. And there is talk, of course, from people in Michigan whose family's livelihood depends on the car industry. What's going to happen to all of those people? We have much to talk about this hour of the program, as David Brooks article in today's New York Times suggested the president, in addition to many other responsibilities, could now be called the car dealer in chief in this country. And what does that mean? It's a big thing for the administration to take over this. We're going to have a lot of phone calls, I'm sure, this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And Donald Grimes is our guest, senior research associate at the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Professor Grimes, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
We have a lot to talk about. Let's start with the governor's claim that perhaps Mr. Wagoner could be viewed as an auto industry martyr. He's a sacrificial lamb. Do you think he is?
Well, I think that's probably true. They had to sacrifice someone, especially after they've gotten all of the heat over bonuses at AIG, although they did replace the CEO of AIG when they gave them the initial money. So it's not completely true that the financial institution CEOs have gotten off scot-free. A lot of them have gone, but they just have not been as well publicized as the departure of Mr. Wagoner.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is an indication that maybe more of those jobs will be, the heads of many of those other bank failure companies may also be asked to resign?
Well, I would be afraid of going back to the government if I was a CEO of one of the banks.
Right.
They would probably say, go somewhere else. And I think that's a political response. It's not really a response to the economic situation because, again, replacing Wagoner or replacing the CEO of AIG, AIG, actually, maybe that was a really good idea. They'd made some really horrible decisions and did reflect badly on the thinking of the management there. But I don't think the problems at General Motors are really driven by their personality. General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, the Detroit Three, as they're now called, they used to be the Big Three, but now they're the Detroit Three, have had problems for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
They've been losing market share. They've been losing money. They've been shrinking. This is a process that's been going on for 30 years. Where they've replaced CEOs, dozens of times in each of these companies. They've done it with people who are insiders, people who are within the company. They brought in people from overseas to run the companies. They brought in people from outside the industry to run the companies. And it never seems to get solved. So I think the problems are much more of a structural issue in the auto industry than just a personality issue. At least in the banking industry, they were making money for most of those years, and it was a competitive industry.
What about a vision problem that they may have? I mean, these figures are pretty striking. In 1994, when Wagoner took charge of GM's American operations, the company made up 33.2% of auto sales. Last month, 18.8% of American car and truck sales. People are shopping for other kinds of cars.
Yep, that's absolutely true, and it's The fact that they're shrinking is a reflection of the fact that essentially they are losing the competitive race against their American-based competition. It was originally the Japanese were bringing in imported vehicles, but increasingly over time, the competition that the Detroiters are facing are based in the United States. They're transplants. They're mostly in southern states. They are all 100% of them are non-union.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really, in some ways, the fundamental problem, or one of the fundamental problems. The second part of their problem that the big three face is that they have these huge legacy costs of large numbers of retirees from when they were bigger companies to now being sustained by a much smaller base. I mean, you need to think of it as sort of an upside-down pyramid where you have all of these retirees being supported by a relatively small number of workers. At General Motors today, the number of retirees is at least five for every active worker. So each active worker has essentially got to generate enough extra revenue to sustain the pension benefits and especially the health care benefits of five retirees. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of concern about Social Security and Medicare, you know, going out 30 years when the United States would get to a situation where there would be roughly 2.5 workers supporting each retiree. Well, think about General Motors. You have one worker supporting five retirees, and that ratio is increasing dramatically every day. And, you know, the situation at General Motors today is more than over 10 times worse than what it would be for the Social Security Medicare looking out 20 or 30 years. So, you know, it's a real hard problem, and I think that people have to realize that essentially that has constrained everything that they have tried to do in management. And again, it's like if you keep replacing these CEOs, you'd think that if it was just a vision problem, you know, not making enough fuel-efficient vehicles or so forth, somebody would have stumbled upon the right solution just by random chance. The problem is much more structural. They have way more retirees that they're trying to sustain, and they've got a union which basically acts as a ball and chain around their ankle in the race against competitors that have neither the retiree costs nor the union constraints.
Right. And yet, in this age of some populist anger about all of this, when you look at what Mr. Wagner walked away with, over $20 million severance here, you think of the number of retirees this man could support, and you hear from the auto workers in Detroit whose family have been dependent on this industry for years and years, and they're scared to death of what's going to happen. You got to figure there's got to be a way for those people to survive as well, for those factories. What's going to happen to all of those people?
Well, it's if you've been in Michigan any time recently, you will see that it's actually in pretty bad shape. The unemployment right there is 12%. The state has lost jobs every year for since 2000 for the last 8-9 years now, and will continue to lose jobs certainly through 2010. You know, it's very sad in Michigan, and people have become almost depressed. I mean, it's as a group, it's sort of a bad situation. Now, that said, I think in some ways Michigan, like Wisconsin, has some great assets that they can build an economy on going forward. The Great Lakes, you guys only have one of them, or two of them, I guess you can count Lake Superior,
right.
But we have five, and that's a great asset. And, of course, the universities, University of Wisconsin system, and, of course, they have different names in Michigan, the University of Michigan, Michigan State, and so forth, but we have some great universities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And both will give an opportunity to build a strong economy in the future. But in the meantime, especially in Michigan, but also in Wisconsin, the loss of these manufacturing jobs, especially those associated with the auto industry, are causing a great deal of pain to a lot of workers.
What does the government expect GM to do in the next 60 days? What were they asked to do?
That's a great question. When I looked at the original submission by General Motors, their plan, it was quite clear that they were over-optimistic. They had sales rebounding tremendously in terms of vehicle sales, getting back up to 17 million units in 2014. We're now running at about a 9 million unit annual rate. And I didn't think there was any way in the world that that was going to happen as people have cut back their spending and increased their savings. They had essentially a projection that they were going to keep their market share at constant over the future, and that was not going to happen. And as the analysis by the Obama administration pointed out, you know, they were expecting to still make huge amounts of profits on their vehicles, selling essentially these SUVs. And so it was, they concluded, and I think correctly, that it was a totally unrealistic plan. And they have to come back and come up with a new plan. And essentially the implication is that, you know, well, sales are not going to be that high, and you guys aren't going to have that much market share. You're going to have to be a lot smaller than what you projected. And again, thinking of that upside-down pyramid, that means that that ratio is going to continue to increase. And I think that raises a question of how General Motors can survive. And I think the reason that they were so optimistic in their projection, I mean, I think they basically sort of looked at the numbers and reached the conclusion that the only way that they could look like a viable company is that if everything went the right way, went the optimistic way, and put those numbers in order to generate the revenue that they needed to sustain their operation. And I think the Obama administration concluded, well,
yeah,
correctly, that it's not going to be there.
And does this country need to have all of those auto companies survive? Some of those companies survive? None of those companies survive?
Well, I think the automobile industry has been a source of technological improvement worldwide, and we're now seeing that in terms of the entire battery sector and fuel propulsion. And so I think it would be a great loss to the United States if we didn't have at least one automobile company and functioning. So we would definitely like to have the automobile company. Of course, you could actually go back to the 1930s and credit the UAW with the creation of the middle class. That being sort of a historical benefit. I don't think it's necessary to have all those the unionized manufacturing workers in order to have a middle class anymore. But they did serve a great purpose historically. And I would like to say we should have an auto industry. It would be important to do it. Every major country in the world wants to have an auto industry, and there's obviously a reason for doing that other than just prestige. But I don't know if we can pull it off. I mean, it's like you now have this huge, I mean, it's a question as to how you can, have a unionized firm competing against a non-union firm. If you go back to economics 101, microeconomics 101, and you look at a competitive industry like that, the high-cost producer is going to go out of business. I mean, that's a lesson you learn in introductory economics, and that's what the big three are. They're the high-cost producers, and so they're going out of business through making poor quality products and not making enough profit. And so I don't know how to answer that question. I would like to say we're going to have one, but I don't know if we're going to have one in the current form.
Isn't that astounding what you just said? I mean, that sort of changes America in some fundamental way, doesn't it?
Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
What you said is just astounding for America to perhaps in the not too distant future not have any car companies.
Yeah, we may not have a car company. I mean, you're in a tough situation, and you may end up. I mean, you go to a bankruptcy judge, which I think General Motors may end up there. And what they're basically going to do would be to essentially throw out all of the legacy costs. The pensions would end up in the federal government's hands, and the health insurance benefits would just go away completely for all retirees.
Yeah.
And then they'll tear up the union contracts impose a wage scale that, I mean, I don't know what the wage scale will be, but it'll be much worse. They'll toss out all of the work rules, I'm sure, and they'll provide much lower levels of benefit. There have been instances where when bankruptcy judges do that, and this has happened in Michigan, that the workers go on strike. The Teamsters led a strike against a car hauling company in Michigan last summer. After a bankruptcy judge said, tossed out the union contract and said, you're taking a 15% pay cut. And the Teamsters went on strike, and a week later, the company shut down completely.
Right.
I mean, it was 3,000 jobs gone. I mean, and that's not, I mean, people get mad, and they don't sort of see they sort of, I think people sort of think there's this big scam going on that that they're being asked to make these unfair sacrifices, and that, you know, I mean, there's no question that they're going to be suffering more pain than Mr. Wagner with his payment. But I don't, you know, there doesn't. The truth is that doesn't matter. The company, the truth, his walking away with $10 million, that works out, I think, to about $100 per GM employee, and you know, that's not going to make a lot of difference in the end.
Yeah, it is symbolically, perhaps. What about Ford? Why is Ford much more viable? They didn't go to the government to ask for money for a bailout. What's going on with that company?
Well, Ford made one incredibly brilliant decision. You talk about people making bad decisions, especially at AIG. Ford, almost 2 years ago, basically went to the capital markets when they were still functioning and mortgaged everything. They accumulated cash. They sold off everything they possibly had. They sold off all their buildings. They even sold off the Blue Oval as a symbol of Ford and raised cash. So essentially Ford accumulated this huge cash situation, which is allowing them to not need to go borrow any money at this time, and therefore they're in a much better financial situation, as of course the capital markets are not functioning. And I think that's their benefit. Now, the problem for Ford is what happens if they run out of cash a year from now, if the auto industry doesn't recover. And I think that's the concern for Ford is what happens if the auto industry sales don't pick up. Will they basically end up in the same boat, maybe even worse?
Yeah. All right, let's welcome phone calls, and I know we'll have many of them. We're talking about the auto industry, which, as our guest suggests, maybe there won't be an American auto industry down the road. The problems here are just too insurmountable. Looking at yesterday's action, the administration, the Obama administration, asking the chief executive of GM to leave, saying that it would take a new vision and a new direction to create the GM of the future. You look at the ripple effects of all of this and the workers who won't have jobs, and what about their health care and retirement, and what other jobs are they going to do, and what does it mean for the U.S. to not have an auto industry, and what does it mean for the government to essentially take this GM over, and what do they have to do in the next 60 days to remain viable, and why is it that Toyota sells more cars now in the United States, and what about the union's benefits and the ability of Toyota and non-union southern states to be able to do this at a lower cost? Does that keep American companies from being able to do what they've done for so long? What a huge issue this is. How many huge issues are there on the table these days? It's unbelievable. Well, join us, okay? Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. And we'll have somebody checking emails as well. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our phone lines are all open, so call somebody. I don't know. Maybe they're not working. I would assume they are. Well, give us a call. There we go. They're working. Our guest is Professor Donald Grimes. He's Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Clarence from Eau Claire. Hi, Clarence.
Hi. I don't hear nobody talking about when Bill Clinton and Bob Dole shoved that NAFTA down our throat, a Republican and a Democrat, if two of them to pass that bill, it was so unpopular. But Robert Wright was the Secretary of Labor, Robert Wright, and he said exactly what was going to happen. We're going to be a service industry, flipping hamburgers, and that's going to be the jobs that the blue-collar Americans are left with. But I honestly don't hear nobody talking about that. I drive truck. I'm in the truck 20 hours a day sometimes, and I really don't hear too many people talk about these trade agreements that kind of sold out to blue-collar workers in America.
All right, Clarence, thank you for your call. How does NAFTA figure into this, do you think, Professor Grimes?
Relatively little. If you were to get rid of NAFTA, which is a trade agreement between the United States and Mexico and Canada, which people do credit as sort of like sending some jobs to Mexico. What would have happened is essentially those jobs either would have gone to another international country, maybe they would have gone to China, they would have gone to Vietnam, maybe the Philippines, or in all likelihood, they would have probably gone to the southern states in the United States working in a non-union production facility. So I don't think that getting rid of NAFTA or not having had NAFTA would have actually saved many of the unionized blue-collar jobs in the United States.
Thanks very much for the call. What is it, though? Let me ask a follow-up on that. What is it that's going to allow people to make a decent wage, to have good health benefits? I mean, you can't fault the unions for being able to secure those pretty good living conditions. Everybody should have a right to that in this country and actually around the world. So how do you reconcile people at plants that are non-union working for less money with people who are at the very top making a whole lot of money? There ought to be a way for everybody to eke out a good living.
Yeah, I think the easiest way would be to get a college degree, either a bachelor's degree or even an associate's degree, because unlike the previous caller, actually the number of jobs sort of in the hamburger flipping industry are actually declining. The areas that are growing are things like healthcare, social services, especially issues that are dealing with the elderly, because the aging of the population is going to put tremendous demand on any sort of service that deals with the elderly. The high end, actually, the highly educated service industry jobs have been growing much faster than the low end service industry jobs. So I think that it's not completely true, the idea that everybody's going to end up in a low paid service industry jobs, but clearly people without education are.
But you're always going to need people who are driving trucks, like Clarence.
Yep, and indeed, the trucking industry has been expanding. Now, it's been set back by this recession. There's no question about that. But if you actually look at the number of job openings that have been pursued for people who are truck drivers over the years, it's actually increased. Of course, part of that is it's a very competitive industry, and of course, it's actually very hard on individual truckers. I mean, they've gone from their family, and it's a very hard job. But there are frequently, at least during that good economic times, many job openings for truck drivers.
Let's go to Tom from Hudson next. Hello, Tom.
Hi. College degree, huh? For an auto worker in his 50s, he's going to be a physician's assistant or a nurse, huh? Give me a break. Now, I want to talk about these high union labor costs you think are the cause of our automakers being uncompetitive. When you compare to Europe and Japan, like Germany, BMW, Mercedes, and the Japanese automakers like Lexus, they are unionized. They make more than American unionized workers. They get 5 weeks paid vacation. They get, you know, strong pensions. And they're very competitive. And so it's not the high union, the high labor costs for unionized workers. It's the insurance company, the health care insurance premiums that are crushing the American auto worker in our company. In Europe and Japan, it's a single payer, a nationalized health care system. That's what we need here. I think it's, $1,400 to $1,600 per car in America that's part of the cost of the car. So it's not the unions. It's the health care insurance companies that are hurting us.
Professor Grimes.
Well, I guess 2 points. First, the American car companies are competing against non-union producers in the South. And those non-union producers do pay health and provide health insurance benefits for their workers. So they're facing some of the same costs. Their health insurance plans are not as generous. And, of course, they are not covering all of the health insurance costs of the retiree population, legacy costs. If you look at what's happening to the auto companies in Europe and in Japan, they are actually moving their production to lower cost countries. In Europe, they're moving to Eastern Europe. That's a huge problem. They've actually had near riots at auto plants in France because the companies are moving jobs to Eastern European countries where labor costs are lower. And then, of course, Toyota and Japanese producers have been doing the same thing in Japan. People move to where costs are lower. And that's just the way the world works. That's what happens when you're in a competitive industry. So economics 101, the high-cost producers go out of business.
What's to happen, though? Let's go back to another part of his question. What's that person to do who's worked in an industry for 35 years, 55 years old, and you see what's coming here perhaps in a few months, and all the people who are selling autos and all the people here in the Midwest, we do a lot of this, who may help to keep the auto industry going with parts, et cetera. How does a country restructure itself to make sure those people don't go to tent cities?
That's actually a very legitimate part of the caller's question. And that is something that we do need to address, and just as actually we do need a national health insurance program, but not for the reasons he suggested. You know, we have, obviously, people who are in their 50s are not going to be retrained very readily to these new occupations that are mostly going to be attractive to younger workers. And I think we're going to have to deal with it in some sort of an income support mechanism. And I think that's going to be the question that the administration has to deal with, as they basically have now taken charge of General Motors, what to do with all these people who are in their 50s, mm-hmm. who are going to lose their job. And they announced a new position where yesterday, a person in the Department of Labor who's going to be trying to help communities and people who are losing their jobs, and I think that's a really useful thing. I don't have any good answers for that, I'm afraid. But it's clearly something we have to deal with to provide
sure.
sustaining lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Tom, for your call. Let's go to John from Appleton. Hi, John.
Yes. My question was that the role that, partly it's the short-term perspective that's characteristic of a lot of American corporations, but in particular the auto industry's opposition to increasing fuel efficiency standards. And they were successful in keeping these efficiency standards low, and as a consequence, they got whipsawed by these rapid increases in gas prices, where other countries where they had high gas taxes, people naturally, as a result, went to fuel-efficient vehicles, and those auto companies knew how to make fuel-efficient vehicles at a profit.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think that's a bit of a myth that's out there. All of the auto companies are hurting now as sales have gone down, and not just the lack of fuel efficiency. It's clear that the American automobile companies did build larger vehicles, although clearly the Toyota and Honda, actually, if you look at their product lineup, they've become less fuel efficient over time. They've started introducing many more full-size pickup trucks, and they've made their cars bigger and less fuel efficient. It seems to be something that is more common than what people believe. It's not the fuel efficiency, I think, that's the real problem with regard to the American automobile companies. I think it's essentially that they are competing with high legacy costs and with union contracts against firms that are not troubled by either issue.
It's interesting that Wagner, and I'm wondering what's behind this, said that his one of the moves that he regretted most was GM's decision to kill the electric car that was leased to customers in the late 90s. Why do you think he said that? And what do you think, maybe this is a small area, maybe it would have changed some things in the auto industry if they had really pushed that kind of car?
I don't know. It's maybe people would have, if they would have invested more in battery research, and they had been a leader of that technology, Their expectation might have been that they could have won this race, but I'm not convinced, given that they would have really sustained it, because essentially they would have gotten a lead when they introduced that technology. But it's clear that other countries' auto industry would have copied it, the technology, and essentially replicated whatever General Motors had learned. And within a few years, essentially, they would have taken the lead. But his legacy would have probably been better. Maybe he was concerned about now he's just going to go out as the guy with who crashed and burned General Motors, whereas if he'd have saved that car company, maybe they would have remembered him more as the guy who invented the electric vehicle.
Right. Thanks, John, for your call. Bob from Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi. I'm suggesting that the auto industry would be much better off if the employees owned it, and if the employees weren't willing to invest in it, then shut it down. It would seem that there'd be a different motivation at the top. Rather than make as much money as we can this quarter, they'd be figuring, how do we keep these families going? And I've seen that motivation in the paper mill in Eau Claire. When new management came in, a new company came in with different motivation, the mill flourished. When it was there because the executives wanted to make a big salary, it did.
I think that's actually an excellent idea. In fact, actually, the auto companies are now so cheap that they could be bought up by anybody for relatively little amount of money. In fact, I think the UAW has about $1 billion or almost $1 billion in their strike fund. I think that would allow them to buy up General Motors just using the strike fund money.
Huh.
And then, you know, it's their show. They could do whatever they want. If they thought that the electric car was the way to go, they could introduce it and be competitive. And I guess they could take that chance. But I think that, you know, they know that essentially the car companies tended to lose money on small vehicles, less fuel-efficient vehicles, that the electric car company, as the Obama administration's auto industry panel said, was not going to, the Volt was not going to solve General Motors' problems. It was going to be too expensive, and there were going to be too few of them sold to solve their problem. In the long run, that's what they reported yesterday in their report. So, and I think the car industry, the car union probably understands that and probably doesn't want to buy it.
It's an interesting question.
I'm not suggesting the union buy it, but the employees buy it. Probably half the employees aren't in the union.
Actually, it's a little higher percentage than that. All of the blue collar workers are pretty much represented by either by pretty much the UAW, I think. Obviously, they have the assets. But essentially, I mean, an ESOP where they basically just turn everything over. I mean, they could almost turn over General Motors for free. Their stock isn't worth anything, and just get out.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's pause for a moment and we'll return. We're talking about what's going on with the auto industry and the government's action, the president asking the head of GM to step aside, which he did. And now we got 60 days for GM and 30 days for Chrysler to come up with some kind of plan to remain viable. And the question is whether or not both of those companies can. And it's a big thing, the government to take over this. So we're talking about all that means, and it's a lot, and welcoming your calls. For our guest, Professor Donald Grimes, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour of our program, the Final Four, of course, taking place this weekend. We're going to be looking at how colleges recruit athletes. The NCAA has lowered the legal level for recruiting basketball players to the 7th grade now. And we're going to be looking at how huge these programs are, how many infractions of the rules there may be. Are there agents who really aren't agents, but they, under the table, are acting like agents for 7th graders and for high school students? And what about the salaries basketball coaches make and the academic rigor of many college programs for sports figures? We'll talk about all of that. Should be a good discussion after 10 o'clock today. Professor Donald Grimes is here now. We go to Katie from Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, I'd like to make a point. I'm not sure if you were mentioned this concerning the unions as I was calling you, but my thought concerning the unions and their position is that it seems to me they're not stepping up to the ownership they have in the situation we are in with the auto industry by not having the foresight to look where the major issues are going to be, for instance, the health care and the retirees, and thinking the future and making the changes that should have come in the auto industry should have come from the union by looking forward, and that we wouldn't be in this position. So if I have, you know, any anger toward anyone in the auto industry, it's going to be toward the unions as well.
And what should they have done, Katie? What makes you mad?
Well, they seem so entrenched in status quo and maintaining what they have fought for in the past that they didn't look forward. They weren't, you know, the avenue to the future. They didn't do their job. They should have been looking forward to things. And I think, for instance, health care costs, innovative ideas for containing health care costs should be coming from the union. Who would know it better than the people who are representing the workers? But you don't hear them talking about that. You really just hear them talking more about maintaining wages and benefits and not innovative thoughts or paradigms.
Professor Grimes?
Well, I think your caller has hit the nail on the head, but I guess I wouldn't. It would be really hard and sort of unfair to sort of blame the union, or they would have been expecting an awful lot about people to be, you know, engaged in that much foresight. I'm afraid it's like my wife keeps telling me that I've got to give up eating any fast food. I know it's bad for me, and of course you still do it. And even though you know what you should do, it's very hard to get people to give up. Give up those things and make sacrifices, and clearly giving up the union benefits would have been a sacrifice. I actually do think in some ways the union leadership understands this pretty well and the problems that they're facing, but I think they're sort of like between a rock and a hard place. It's like, well, how do they convince the rank and file, which elects them, to do the hard thing? And I think, you know, the politicians do the same thing. I mean, for years, everybody knows that we're going to have tax increases, that we're going to have a reduction in the entitlements that are provided to our senior citizen population, both retirement and Social Security and Medicare. Everybody knows that those budgets are unsustainable, but obviously nobody wants to talk about that or certainly propose anything. When you do, you lose.
Thanks very much, Katie, for your call. Let's go to Randy from Lavelle. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi, Professor. I wonder if what your reaction is to this. I look at this a little differently. What I wonder is if there's not a great capacity to survive. I mean, we're Americans. I think that it's the market that they're not looking at. Americans want a certain type of automobile. And if they put their ear to the ground and see what people want, having raised, I happen to have raised four children, all spaced about 3 years apart, which is, by the way, that's a terribly difficult spacing for children because none of them sort of can take the next one to the same basketball game, but they all are spread out, and you get a great sense of the market by the time you're done with a family of that size. And this I know, they just weren't paying attention to the market that what people wanted in automobiles. What I think is they don't communicate good with their dealers. If you ask a dealer, the dealer's frustrated. He'll say, well, you folks learn more in the media than we know. And on the other hand, if you go to a Honda guy, they got a compressed natural gas vehicle that you got to put your name on a list for. The Toyota people seem to have the style the young folk want. Now, in the case of Ford, I know when my daughter went out to look for a car, she did pick a Ford Focus. And I want to tell you that she's gone to college now, and it's still here, and my wife and I take that. There is nothing wrong with that Focus. Ford might be surviving because they paid attention to the market. So what I'm wondering is, since you're into this, could it be that maybe they slipped away from looking at the market a little bit?
Professor Grimes.
Well, I think you have to do two things. First is that, it's like, why would they want to be stupid? And to sit there and think that they intentionally didn't do it. I mean, they may have mistaken what the market is, but I doubt they would do it intentionally. Reading the market, there have been successes by the American automobile companies. I mean, it was Chrysler came along with the minivans. When those were first introduced, those were seen as great innovations. And then Ford, in particular, came along with the SUVs and the Explorer originally, and that was seen as a great innovation that sold a lot of vehicles. So they've come up with things at different times in the past that have succeeded. And, of course, actually, they've been very successful in overseas. Opel in Germany was a good brand. And in China, Buick was selling, had a leading market share in China. So you can't say that they've always just universally made horrible decisions. It sort of comes back and forth, and I guess in the end, it's whether or not you've got the capital resources that you've accumulated over the years to survive sort of the downturns, and also the flexibility to change your production processes. And that's part of the problem with the union contracts, is essentially everything has to be negotiated with the UAW. The company can't just make a decision in terms of what plants to open or close or what to do with the workers, and they're always sort of trying to balance their product mix with at these different plants with their existing workforce, because they can't shift it around quite as easily as a non-union firm.
Let me do a follow-up on that, though. I don't know who came up with the decision to make Hummers, which seems to me to be wildly crazy, but going back to the minivans and the vans, it seems to me as though the American automakers did take their eyes off the prize in not marketing, a fairly simple list of requirements, a car that's well-made, that's relatively inexpensive, that's safe, and that's fuel-efficient. Because we're always going to have these waves of oil prices going up and going down, and they've been wildly expensive during, several cycles in my lifetime, and people are always going to want that kind of car. And it seems to me as though foreign cars have known that. Europe drives those kinds of cars, and Japan gives us those kinds of cars, and we like them, and we always have, and it seems to me as though we always will, instead of a Hummer.
Well, there's certainly a certain segment of the American population that has that ideology and that belief structure. But the best-selling vehicles in the United States are pickup trucks. I think it was the Ford F-150 or Chevy vehicle. They sell like 500,000 units when times were good of those vehicles. The second best were the Toyota Camry. That's actually the car. And I think the Honda Accord. Those are both, and they've been growing over time in terms of their size, and they become less fuel efficient over time. So I think that the market sort of indicates that it's, that while it's great rhetorically and you can see small scale benefits that way, it's not quite as true as I would like to believe, including me. But I mean, if you look at the sales, the Prius sales have collapsed with gas prices having gone down. They're actually down over 50% year over year. Getting people to buy smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles may, and claiming people that's what they want, that may fit certain perceptions of people, but I don't think it really matches up with what's going on in the marketplace. Hmm.
Thanks, Randy, for your call. Bobby is next from Stevens Point. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And welcome to Wisconsin, Professor Grimes. I want to follow up on this fuel problem. It's good that you just said that. First of all, it's highly ironic. I think James Howard Kunstler would find it highly ironic that the auto industry is collapsing not so much because of peak oil, but because of peak credit or peak cheap money. So in that ironic situation, we've taken our eyes completely off the peak oil problem. But anyone who follows this knows that there's huge destruction of supply going on globally. In other words, the rig count of drilling rigs running in the United States is down about 50% from last summer, but gasoline demand is only down 5%. So, and this is a global pattern. So my the way I look at it is the only future that there should be for General Motors and Chrysler and perhaps Ford is making mass transit vehicles, primarily light rail that runs on renewable energy. And I think our infrastructure stimulus plan is taking us right down the wrong road. The only roads we should be building now from now on are the railroads. So I'll listen to your comments
okay.
off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
I think that the fact that oil prices have come back down a lot is actually, as a caller suggested, really undermining the need to become more fuel efficient in the future. That's, I think, one of the things that people should have tried to figure out is a way to provide almost a controlled price of oil so that essentially they get to a level and don't fluctuate quite as drastically, especially because once they slip like this, you undermine, as the caller suggested, all of the fuel efficiency gains. And I think that's a tragedy, and that'll cause problems. We went through this once before in the 1980s when fuel prices went up and then they went down and everybody changed their behavior. And I think people do respond to higher prices, and higher prices for fuel would have certainly sustained the changing process. I'm not certain that it would have saved GM, Ford, or Chrysler, but we as a country would have been better off and as a world.
Mark is next from De Pere. Hi, Mark.
My question is simply, which expert or economist was sounding the alarm that no one else heard? I've heard that Yale economist Robert Shiller predicted a terrifying real estate meltdown. He still thinks it's going to be plunging. Home prices will plunge 40% before we're done with this. And he predicted that 2 years ago. Is there anyone else out there who predicted that this sort of calamity could have happened?
There were a few people, but I think you're right that most economists missed this one, including myself. I think we had, as a profession, misunderstood the linkage between sort of the real economy, sort of the production side of the economy, and essentially the finance side of the economy. And we didn't appreciate the fact that that asset values started going down, that people would default at such a huge rate on their homes, and that so much of our economy was essentially built on credit and borrowed money. And essentially that wasn't feeding into our models, so to speak. So that's sort of a mea culpa for economists, and hopefully we'll learn something, and we won't repeat that mistake again.
Here's an email. In the next minute, we're almost out of time. From Mike in Krivitz, Ford's presence in Europe, even counting Jaguar and Volvo problems, seems to be much better than Chrysler or GM. They're poised to introduce U.S. versions of European models that ought to do well. Would you agree that Ford may potentially reap a lot of goodwill and huge benefits as GM and Chrysler contract dramatically?
Yes, I think Ford's got I think they were fortuitous in selling everything and raising cash a year and a half ago, and that's well-positioned them going forward, assuming that we begin to get an increase in motor vehicle sales. If motor vehicle sales stay down at about a 9 million unit annual rate, all the auto companies, even the foreign auto companies, are going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have time for even one more call then for about the next 45 seconds. Susan from Bristol, hi.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Susan.
Just a couple of quick comments. I've been a manager in the car business for 23 years, and mostly for GM, mostly for Chevrolet. Two different comments about we have been trying to be the squeaky wheel with the manufacturer for a long time, okay? We couldn't get over the last 2 years allocations for cars. Now, for example, the Malibu and the Impala, which is a full-size sedan, both get over 30 miles to the gallon. Mm. We couldn't get them unless we unloaded enough big trucks, Tahoes, and Suburbans. And we would tell them what the customers are looking for, and we couldn't get it for a long time. So the dealerships got hit first before the manufacturer got hit. And another thing is being a finance manager also. I saw for years and years giving out the 0% and the 2.9 and the 0% and the 1.9 all over in these ridiculous lease rates that they were giving out. I knew they were going under. I knew that there was no way that they could do this. And I don't know who's in charge over there, but they really made some. It was like they were borrowing from Peter to pay Paul constantly.
We're out of time. Susan, if you don't mind, I'm going to put you on hold and ask John Treader to get your, if you don't mind, we may want to talk to you sometime down the road on the air. So we'll get your phone number. Professor Grimes, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Great interest in this topic. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Professor Donald Grimes, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, John Treader on air production. We return following the news.